and I'm excited to introduce Dr. Michelle Heacock. She is our acting director of the NIEHS Superfund Research Program, and she will introduce our series. Michelle?
Thank you, Danielle. I'm excited to be here. Just kind of take a, I'll walk you through a few slides. But because the Superfund Research Program, or SRP, may be new to some of the audience members here, I just wanted to give you some context for our program. So the SRP fosters multidisciplinary research and innovative strategies focused on solving problems related to the nation's Superfund sites. So the SRP was founded as part of the Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act, or SARA, of 1986. The Superfund legislation created a broad university-based research program to address the wide array of scientific uncertainties facing the National Superfund program. The legislation assigned this grant program to the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences, or NIEHS. The SARA established a broad mandate and set of goals for NIEHS to pursue within the SRP. I won't read through them on the slide, but the mandates you're seeing depicted in these arrows include the elements of determining health effects, helping to assess risk, detection, and remediation of hazardous substances related to Superfund sites. So the SRP mission is to provide practical science-based solutions to protect human health and aims to understand and reduce exposure to potentially harmful contaminants. It encourages and supports scientists who are exceptional in their field, drawing some of the nation's best minds to focus on complex problems relevant to hazardous substances. Next slide, please. So the Superfund Research Program, or SRP, includes several grant mechanisms you see here on the slide to fund research that meets the goals of our mandates. The majority of the program is funded under the P42 mechanism, which is our multi-project center grant. So we also fund individual research projects, or R01, small businesses, and others to investigate emerging health issues, emerging health environmental issues. So I encourage you to check out the SRP website to learn more about new and upcoming SRP opportunities. The link is in the slide, and it's under the resources in the webinar homepage. Next slide, please. So here's a map of our currently funded P42 centers. The centers that were funded in 2022, which will be presenting throughout this webinar series, are depicted in red. So we encourage you to visit our website if you want to learn more about each of these centers and the ones that aren't featured during this series. Next slide, please. So as I mentioned just a couple of slides ago, the cornerstone of the SRP is the P42 multi-project centers. So P42 grantees or grant recipients provide sound science, data, information, and knowledge to improve public health by supporting integrative multidisciplinary research. Each center must have at least 2 environmental science and engineering projects or non-biomedical research projects, and 2 biomedical science projects that are supported by core elements that are designed to support the center's goals, including data management and analysis, community engagement, research translation and training the next generation of environmental health scientists. So importantly, each center has a unifying theme, often related to a particular chemical contaminant or a population, for instance, at risk of increased risk of exposure. So this highly simplified systems diagram that you're seeing is meant to illustrate the effective interactions of the components of the center. It depicts the dynamic nature, interdependencies, and how the components of the center interact. It's not simply bidirectional interactions. Each feed and affect each other. So within a center, the system works towards addressing a problem and creating solutions related to the unifying theme and research goals of the center. Next slide, please. Will you go back, Molly, please? I didn't. One thing that I wanted to highlight was what we are depicting here today is the importance of our research translation function. And this is depicted in the left rectangle. Next slide, please. So the progress in research webinar series highlights promising research from new and returning P42 multi-project centers funded by us in 2022. So as I almost didn't mention, research translation is a central component of SRP. And these webinars are really helping to facilitate a dialogue between researchers, field practitioners, and stakeholders early in the stages of research progress so that these new projects are on a trajectory for successful technology transfer and application by end users. So today's webinar is the first of four, and we encourage you, if you can, to attend them all. If you can't, they will be recorded for you to view at your leisure. So with that, I thank you for participating today and your attention, and I'm now going to pass it back off to Dr. Daniel Carlin, who will introduce today's webinar, presentations, and speakers.
Thanks so much, Michelle. That was a really great background. So now it's my pleasure to introduce our speakers, and we're going to start with Texas A&M University Superfund Research Program Center. And we are joined today by Dr. Yvonne Rusin. He is a professor in the Department of Veterinary Physiology and Pharmacology and the director of the Texas A&M SRP Center. We're also joined by Dr. Garrett Sansom, a research assistant professor in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health. And Dr. Natalie Johnson is also joining us. She is an associate professor in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health, and she's the vice chair of the Interdisciplinary Toxicology Program. So Dr. Rusin, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Danielle, and thank you all for joining. My name is Yvonne Rusin. I'm a professor at Texas A&M University, and I direct our Superfund Research Center. So as Michelle said, the Superfund centers are focused on problems and solutions. So for our Superfund center that was funded originally in 2017, the problem is redistribution of chemicals in the environment due to natural and man-made disasters. And essentially, you can think of this as the perennial chemical mixtures problem. However, these are chemical mixtures that are being created rapidly by a particular event. And usually these events are very large scales. So the number of individuals who may be impacted by chemicals that could have been redistributed in the environment is very large. And the solution to that problem that our center set out 5 years ago or more to address was to develop tools and models that can be used for rapid hazard and exposure assessment. And when we proposed this center back in 2016, we proposed a hypothetical scenario that was models on the Hurricane Ike that came through the Houston Ship Channel and impacted one of the largest industrial areas in the United States, which is the greater Houston. And we were interested in preparing ourselves and our colleagues in local, state, and federal government to respond to disasters like this. Well, we thought it was a theoretical exercise and we would do science, but in essence, immediately after we received our notice of award, our team was responding to Hurricane Harvey in the greater Houston area. And then in 2018, we were part of the response to Hurricane Florence. And then in 2019, our center has done a lot to work on the Intercontinental Terminals Company fires. And you may have seen some of the publicity earlier this week on reconstructing those events back from 2019. So these problems are not theoretical, and the solutions have to be very, very practical. So in our renewal application, we have wanted to strengthen some of our approaches. And as Dr. Hickok already pointed out, there is a certain way these centers are put together. And in our particular case, we have six cores and five projects. And these five projects span the continuum from rapid exposure assessment using some of the non-target methods, also working with air quality exposures, and then following those up with in vitro and in vivo studies. And you'll hear from Dr. Natalie Johnson from our project two. Our project three is developing some of the microphysiological systems that can be used to analyze samples rapidly and evaluate potential hazards in pregnancy. And project four is looking at intra-individual and intra-tissue variability, again, using some of the novel microphysiological systems. And our project five is developing broad-acting sorbent materials. But we all are taking a one-center approach to disaster research response, and a number of our cores, including community engagement core that you'll hear about from Dr. Sansom, is really part of this disaster research response. So without further ado, I'll pass the microphone to Dr. Sansom and let him introduce his work and his colleagues in the Community Engagement Corps. Eric?
Great. Thank you so much. Good morning, good afternoon, depending on where you are. So my name is Garrett Sansom. I'm an assistant professor at the Texas A&M School of Public Health, and I'm an environmental epidemiologist and an investigator as part of the CEC. So I just want to talk a little bit about kind of what we do and give an example and kind of walk through how we maintain these relationships. So on a 1,000-foot view, the Community Engagement Corps works with both communities as well as the different projects and core within the Superfund Research Center at Texas A&M. And this is everything from working proactively to plan for or respond to specific environmental risks that are related to everything from emergency containment events, but also just immediate risk in the aftermath of certain types of hazards, which will be the example I'll give later on. But it's not just for research sake. We do create both a participatory-based intervention, so we do our best to work alongside communities and let them be a part of each aspect of it, as well as create citizen science programs and tools that can help both in the immediate aftermath or prior to these hazard events, because it has a bunch of buy-in from the local communities. And it's one of the ways in which that we can maintain long-term the relationships in specific areas to help build local resilience to the community by having increased capacity in this form amongst other ways. We also find that when we do it in this fashion, people are more interested in both solutions, the data, they can use the information for their own means, as well as perhaps advocacy work or their own projects moving forward. So it's really kind of a win-win on both the research as well as the local community desires and needs. And the Community Engagement Corps is really the aspect of the Superfund Center that connects all the different projects and corps to the community to be able to do that work. Next slide, please. So how do we do this? So we utilize the community engagement research framework that you can see on there. There's a lot of different aspects of how this works, but on the broad view, it's linking both the research expertise as well as the local expertise at every stage, from everything from proposing the project, having help identifying specific and utilizing the local knowledge, then through the life of the project, and then ultimately disseminating that information back to the communities, as well as more standard locations like manuscripts or conferences and that kind of thing. But we really try to get that data and the information to the communities prior to that, because they were so integral in both the thinking of the issues as well as being a part of the collection itself. So being able to, if for instance, one of the project of course has a effort that they're putting out in a specific area, we have six, 7 years of relationships built throughout lots of areas in the Houston area, the Houston Ship Channel, the so-called petrochemical corridor, but throughout other parts of Texas as well, including Central Texas and South Texas, that are beginning growing because they all have different unique needs. We help a lot of the different projects and corps with those efforts, and that's everything from holding numerous community meetings or even doing workshops to come up with specific solutions based on the information that we've gotten. So we really try to close that loop on the effort, research, and then translation efforts to be able to give them a complete project and a complete product that walks through everything we found in a way that makes sense for them and in a way that they actually want. Next slide, please. So I'm just going to give a quick example. We can do numerous ones, but this is just one that was led by the Deer 2 project that CC led and assisted with Deer 2 project. So there's a part of Texas that's called the Flash Flood Alley, just by nature of the hills and the narrow valleys and the numerous rivers and creeks that exist in this part. Large scale flood events can cause pretty rapid flash flooding. And unfortunately, in the towns of Wimberley and San Marcos, there was a rather serious event, sometimes called the Memorial Day flood, that did cost lives. So next slide, please. So this is just an example. There was a house that's shown there on the far left, 100 Deer Crossing, that was actually on Stilts, like the house was raised up and it got approval for a 500-year flood. Unfortunately, during the Memorial Day floods, the flooding was so bad, the house actually lifted off of those supports and went down the Blanco River, and it struck a bridge, which, you know, crushed the home. And unfortunately, a whole family was in there. Only one person actually ended up escaping from that event. So it caused serious issues throughout, not just Wembley, but also the other town of San Marcos. So next slide. So what we did is we responded and began linking with specific organizations in the community to try to see what issues were there, how we can help, and if there was a place for our efforts. So just for instance, one of the groups we linked with was the Blanco River Academy. So we held a community meeting and worked with some local partners to try to see what possible issues there were. So the initial concerns were things around warning signs in recovery. Did people get warnings to not, you know, cross certain rivers or to evacuate if they needed to? Did they follow through with those warnings? There was concern over potential environmental contamination that could be associated with the flooding into the community. They wanted a lot of interest on how they can build local resilience to specific climate change issues. Unfortunately, what we're finding, not just here, but throughout the country, a lot of the older maps and predictions are no longer holding true, and we're seeing more serious events happen quicker than we were expecting to see them. And then also a public health education about future events to be able to get everyone in line with proper community responses. So as part of this, we did a community survey in both San Marcos and Wimberley area. And for that, we utilized the Community Assessment for Public Health Emergency Response, sometimes called a CASPER. It's developed by the CDC to give a generalizable data for the whole community. And we also started and began leading a citizen science project in the area based around these types of experiences. And so this is the citizen science project. We have been working with them now. We're going on our third year, and they've collected now hundreds of soil samples, hundreds of water samples. We created a whole curriculum on how to do this work, how to interpret this work. We work with other folks as part of the TechSAM Superfund Center to present this data in a fun and interesting way to both educate them, but also they're collecting baseline data for us. And then they get to keep this information as we move along and begin moving forward. So we have nice longitudinal environmental data in Hays County, which is where San Marcos and Wimberley is located. Next slide. So just as an example, you can see on the right, this is one of the certifications we have. A&M has approved a citizen science certificate for folks who complete the curriculum. One of the graduations is actually coming up May 20th for our South Texas citizen science program. And so we get to really honor and show our appreciation for that. If they're high school age and they're sitting in college, they can get a letter of recommendation from myself and other folks in the Superfund Research Center. But what did we find? We found that cohesion was associated, just to give you some quick overviews here, cohesion was associated with more robust recovery during the short periods of the flooding. We also found that if people, depending on where people heard their warning signs to evacuate, and we found this to be true also with human caused hazards like the ITC petrochemical fire, we found that unless you heard those warnings from people in the community, you actually were not more likely to actually listen to them. So if you heard it from national sources, you weren't necessarily more likely to respond than if you heard it from friends or family, social media, which is also friends or family, or a local source. So it really showed the importance of being part of the community prior to event. Environmental sampling revealed a swift reduction in heavy metals in the months and years following the specific event. So we do see it in moving and distributing throughout different parts of the community. And we have nice baseline data. And so, as I mentioned, we have establishment now of several formal citizen science programs. We are actively engaging in starting new ones in Fur High School in Houston, Texas. We're actually discussing it this summer for a fall program. And then, as I mentioned, the Colonia Citizen Science Program at Callan is coming to a close for our graduation May 20th. And so it really puts together this long-term assistance and lets us stay in it for the duration of this and future events moving forward with this program. So when we put this back into it, we both train folks in the Superfund Center and are trained by folks in the Superfund Center and give this information to the community and are trained by the community. So we try to make it a really dialectical relationship with all of the different groups so we can share all the experience that we had with future trainees, with faculty, how best to do this type of work. We can give those hands-on training on how to do sampling campaigns, how to work in the environment, how to work in communities, particularly at very vulnerable times. We can put together those case studies that can be so important in building larger term, long-term projects with specific locations. And we can actually put together possible solutions, right? So we have green-based solutions that we can put together based on the environmental conditions that we can work with different communities, different cities to see if they can actually afford, or we can work within a scale on what they can afford to be able to implement these solutions that we have. And we do numerous report back to the community, often having hundreds and hundreds of folks from there coming out and learning more about what we did. So thank you for this quick overview of what the CEC is.
Thank you, Garrett. And we'll take again questions at the end. So please submit those in the using the resources that were described. And we'll then go on next to Dr. Natalie Johnson, who will give an example of our new project, Project 2.
Hi, it's my pleasure to be here today to introduce our new project, Project 2, Responding to Air Pollution in Disasters. I'm lucky to be surrounded by an amazing team of co-investigators and trainees. And so as seen on the slide here, I'm collaborating with Dr. Carolyn Cannon, who's an MD, PhD, pediatric pulmonologist at Texas A&M, and then also with Drs. Alan Robinson and Albert Presto at Carnegie Mellon University, who have expertise in air quality and spatial mapping, which is an integral part of our project. We're also leveraging our T32 training program in regulatory sciences and environmental health to also provide funding for postdocs and students that are working on this project. And so I joined as part of the center renewal really in response to what Dr. Rusin showed in his initial slides with the wealth of inhalation toxicology hazards, particularly in the greater Houston area. And so it's known that residents living adjacent to Superfund sites are disproportionately exposed to airborne pollutants. They also have a higher risk of chronic respiratory disease. And one of those in particular of community concern is asthma, and especially childhood asthma. So since there's really a lack of information on hazard identification for these complex mixtures of volatile organic compounds, our project really felt we wanted to fill the gap in looking at both what was in the real world from an exposure perspective, and then what this meant for pediatric health, since asthma was such a major concern in communities living adjacent to some of these sites at high risk for disasters. So an overview of our project encompasses three major aims. And so in our first aim, we're actually in the laboratory developing rapid models to look at hazard identifications for VOCs and VOC mixtures. We're utilizing a cell line, the 16-HBE, which is a bronchial epithelial cell line, to screen VOC-related respiratory endpoints. And then we're also expanding to use primary pediatric bronchial epithelial cells, so we can also look at population variability responses in our model system. Next year, we'll be getting more into aim two, which is really trying to understand the mechanisms of action underlying how exposures to VOCs may underlie asthma risk. And so we're looking at the role of extracellular vesicles, or EVs, which are secreted by cells and known to cause altered signaling that may actually be responsible for development of asthma and other respiratory conditions. And then finally, in aim three, we're really out in the real world looking at the characterization and the distribution of VOCs in kind of normal times and also in response to disasters. And of course, our project is greatly synergized by all the other projects and the core support, as Garrett just mentioned, through the relationships in the community engagement, through also Risk and Geospatial Sciences Corps, which helps us do a lot of our interpretation of dose response and mapping. Training is integral, and of course, our Disaster Research Response Corps. We're highly integrated with multiple projects, and one collaboration that I'll point out is with our Project 5, an engineering project that's developing novel sorbent materials. In the past, they focused on sorbing different pollutants in soil and water, and now we're looking at strategies for sorbing benzene in the ambient air because it is a chemical of major concern. We developed this table prior to our renewal submission, and this is the table we're still working off now for our project. And this is just showing many different hazardous VOCs alongside their ATSDR rank. Those that are highlighted in green are chemicals that we're routinely detecting in air from our ambient air sampling that's predominantly been in the greater Houston area. What we can do is then take these first singly and then in sort of designed mixtures to look at what the hazard response is. And so again, we're working with those 16 HVE cells. We differentiate them at air-liquid interface. So they actually are what would be representative of kind of a human lung. And then a real strength of our project is the capability to tether our exposure system to a mass spectrometer that can measure the dose in real time. And this gets really important when you start to look at, can you monitor the contributions of various mixtures as we do the exposures? We're looking at a variety of endpoints, and that's what you can see here on the slides, such as epithelial barrier integrity and function, cytotoxicity, and also looking at inflammation. And so what these images here in green are showing, two different markers, E-cadherin and Z01, which stands for zonal occludin, showing that you do have a nice intact epithelial barrier layer. And then we can assess after an exposure to a VOC like benzene, is there a break in that barrier that's causing some of the underlying pathology? We also can do measurements as shown here in figure C of the transepithelial electrical resistance or tear measurements, which is really showing for the gray plot there. This is showing a filtered air exposure where you have a nice barrier formation and function. And then after a 3-hour exposure to benzene, you actually have a decrease in that barrier, causing a decrease in the tear measurement. At the same time, in D, you can see that exposure causes an increase in the release of lactate dehydrogenase or LDH, indicating that there is cytotoxicity. We're also coupling this with the real-world measurements in AIM-3. And so we developed what's called our Mobile Responding to Air Pollutions and Disasters, or MRAPID VAN. Again, utilizing that mass spectrometer shown here again, which stands for a proton transfer reaction, time of flight mass spectrometer, or like I like to nickname, just a super fancy and powerful breathalyzer machine. You can actually blow into it in real time, or we can couple it on our van to take measurements of air in real time. And every second, we're collecting data points on VOCs in the air. And it's very powerful when you couple that with location through GPS to be able to identify overall distributions in communities and also look at potential hotspot areas. These images are shown from some of the work we did with Garrett's group and the Community Engagement Corps on our maiden voyage on a hot summer day in Texas, alongside the Houston Ship Channel in a neighborhood known as Manchester. And so kind of you can see in green Hartman Park, and you can see the swings with the kind of smokestacks in the back. This is a heavy industrial area. And children are often, you know, in these parks playing and potentially having respiratory responses to some of these environmental exposures. We did some initial field validations alongside the Texas Commission for Environmental Quality, the TCEQ Smart Van. They have a SIFT MS, which is similar, but it's at a much higher detection limit. We're able to get very low detection limits, actually down to parts per trillion. But we wanted to go alongside them and have some internal validation that when they were seeing peaks, we were seeing peaks as well. And this is an example of some of those data where you can see time on the x-axis, and then on the y-axis, you can actually see concentration for a variety of different VOCs. And as we're driving along, we might see a plume, and actually then the levels would go up. And then it's up for us to work with Garrett on how can we interpret this data and inform communities of what some of the hazards may be. And of course, we can't call a van an MRAPID van and not really get involved with some of the emergencies that are happening in the Midwest really in current time. Since we were already collaborating with the Robinson and Presto group at Carnegie Mellon, they were located in Pittsburgh, about a 45-minute drive from East Palestine. And following the train derailment and controlled burn, we were able to send our trainees, both from Project 2 and the Community Engagement Corps, to do sampling, first with the Carnegie Mellon one van, and then eventually, and what we're doing now, sustained sampling with our Texas A&M MRapid van. I'm showing some data here for benzene levels, which were initially monitored from EPA stationary monitors. And we felt that our role as an academic institution was providing complementary data that may have enhanced spatial resolution and putting some of this data into context. So what you see with those violin plots on the other side for benzene are comparisons of concentration from the response during Hurricane Florence, from the US EPA monitors, from the stationary monitors in East Palestine, from the Carnegie Mellon spatial sampling, and from Carnegie Mellon sampling in Pittsburgh. So we can make comparisons of what does it look like in what traditionally is more of a rural community to what you would see in levels in downtown Pittsburgh. We also were able to rapidly deploy in response to the recycling plant fire in Richmond, Indiana, which was about 4 hours from East Palestine in April. And what's shown here are the sampling sites, one looking at rural background at about 40 miles away at a site that was very close to the fire. And our team was there when things were still kind of smoldering. And this was actually within the evacuation zone. And then at a little bit further site two, which was just outside of the evacuation zone. Again, we're trying to provide context for what these levels mean. And while there is a lot of variability in the levels across the background and the sites for acrolein, benzene, and toluene, I will call your attention to hydrogen cyanide, which was detected at higher levels at site one on both visit one and visit two, then with detectable decreases at site two. All of these levels were elevated in comparison to the most recent air toxics data, that's the US NADA data for the overall US in Indiana. So again, our center and specifically our project is able to provide these measurements in real time and put it into context. Not only are we able to do this for known compounds, but we're also currently doing untargeted analysis to look for other potential compounds that may be of concern. And so this is showing here, one of those that was detected was acrolein. And so the map is actually from the initial February sampling in East Palestine. And you can see the brighter kind of red and orange colors mean that these were detected at up to 3 times higher than what you normally would detect in downtown Pittsburgh. So this is where the spatial capability really comes into play. We also wanted to continue measuring what the levels may be over time throughout the remediation and recovery process. So these are a couple of pictures from the field showing the soil remediation and also the stream aeration really close to a public park. And we can see that overall, again, you can have some peaks that will be increased in certain areas. And this is in context to a rural background, Ohioville, overall acrolein levels, these were from measurements made in March, were slightly elevated. We're continuing our analysis and hope to follow up as the recovery efforts continue in East Palestine. For my final slide, I'll just mention a couple of the next steps that we have. Again, looking at the mixtures identification, and that will be taken from the field measurements in these very unique settings from, you know, East Palestine, a chemical train derailment, from Indiana, you know, a recycling fire. And then next, looking at the population variable responses, we have a resource from the lung map biorepository where we have donor from pediatric cases that range across different ages, across sex, and across different race and ethnicities. And then, of course, in the next year, we'll be getting into that deeper mechanistic role of extracellular vesicles and if some of these changes within these vesicles may serve as potential biomarkers of risk. Thank you so much. I look forward to the question and answers.
Thank you, Natalie and Garrett. And I just want to leave everyone with a couple of examples of activities that our center is putting up. There's a HazWarper retraining in June, and also we invite everyone to look into attending our disaster research training workshop that will be happening over 2 days in December. And we will be sharing these slides, and registration is limited for both events. So thank you very much again, and I'll stop sharing at this time, and we'll go into question and answer.
Great. Thank you all so much. That was really wonderful to hear from what you all are doing. So I think we'll just go ahead and go into the Q&A. And I do encourage our audience to please submit your questions to the Q&A pod. So this question comes in, is the mobile VOC van limited to specific VOCs like benzene, or can it do a full VOC scan in real time?
No, one of the strengths is that it can do full scan in real time. So I showed some examples for some of the chemicals that we knew were of concern based on the stationary monitoring data, but we're also looking at, you know, a range of masses using untargeted approaches to identify those chemicals that may be of concern but aren't currently being measured routinely.
Great, thanks. Another question that we received earlier before the webinar was, this is for Dr. Sansom. What would you say are the biggest challenges the researchers face when working with communities?
Well, I always like to say it's my favorite and hardest part of the job, because it's because you're dealing with people, right? So we're all coming with our own issues. I think the hardest part is the relationship building being able to, well, let me rephrase it this way. Let me tell you the one of the best practices when doing all these things, because it's all of the different human components that are challenging. One is, I think, having expectations really clearly, and this is something that we're getting better and better at. We've certainly made these mistakes, but having the expectations being very clearly outlined from the get-go. How much are you going to be working with them? How often are you going to be having these meetings? We try to do bi-monthly meetings with all of our longstanding community partners, and we try to set those very specific expectations on the citizen science programs, which grad students are going to be going down during what time. But I think that the biggest challenge with community engagement is the initial introductions, right? Making sure we do a really good job at that, having expectations to be really clearly monitored, and then doing your best to honor those specific engagement opportunities that we need to go out over and over again. But again, when you're dealing with people, we're all flawed, and sometimes things, sometimes it's not a good fit. But that's
part of the challenge. And just to add to that, as what Dr. Johnson mentioned, is sharing this data soon enough. These are complex data sets, whether they are soil samples, water samples, or air quality samples. Citizens are asking for this information immediately, and I think what our center has learned a lot from our East Palestine response and how we started sharing information, because this is research-grade instrument operated in a real field. There are reams of data. There's really not a lot of standard ways to analyze it, but we found a way to do these releases gradually as soon as we have comfort level. But also, we cannot just simply post tables of data as our federal and state colleagues usually do without much interpretation. We really need to contextualize. So using maps, using geospatial analyses really allows us to do a better job in explaining this complex information to the citizens.
Yeah, thank you
for
adding that, because that's absolutely true. Because one of the things we hear time and time again in areas that have had other researchers go is that they're tired of just having, again, these tables or raw data thrown at them without being able to fully interpret or understand them. So, yeah, that's an excellent point.
So I think the next question kind of complements what you were just discussing, but how are you interpreting the health implications of the concentrations that you're observing? Are you comparing them to RFDs, background concentrations, and how are you communicating those findings?
So let me start on that to maybe relieve our researchers and community engager epidemiologists from that. The answer is both. So we have had quite a bit of experience dating back to 2017 and Hurricane Harvey, where Dr. Sansom's group and our partners at NGOs started using handheld monitors and actually analyzing air quality data in Houston, the same thing for ITC fires. And the journalists are drawn to the kind of the sensationalism, the this high level at was detected and people should have been evacuated. But having expertise in risk assessment in our center and the risk assessment explanation and using analyses that are not just simply comparing them to current standards, but also calculating what that particular short-term spike can actually mean in the long-term consequence, because our state and federal colleagues frequently have standards for, let's say, week-long exposure or for occupational exposures or for lifetime exposures. But these, short-term spikes are very, very difficult to communicate. So what we're using both, maps and comparing to local background. And that's what Dr. Sansom said, that's, critical in disasters where usually do not have background information. So what we started doing is collecting a lot of background data where we know disasters will happen in the future. But also, we have to explain and be patient in the community meetings or talking to journalists or actually posting data on Twitter in explaining when we draw a federal or state exposure limit, we actually are saying that even if it's going up, what does it mean? So it's been a, I think, point of contention between us and our state and federal partners who tend to say zero PPM and just forget about it or say it's safe. And we are trying to contextualize a little deeper. And we've accumulated a lot of knowledge and experience as to how to do that. And we're still learning.
Great. Thank you. So the next question came in is, sorry if you already mentioned this, but how much does a mobile unit cost, such as the purchase and maintenance, et cetera?
I guess I can take this one. So we received about $500,000 grant within our institution from Texas A&M University to purchase the mass spec and also put it on board the mobile van and make it capable. We're still, you know, looking at the maintenance cost really is in the ability to buy the standard gases, to do the calibration, to do the appropriate quality controls, and this is the cost of travel.
And just to add to that, you know, not all of these costs are, you know, research costs that can be, you know, put or provided through NIH. So we've been fortunate to have institutional support from Texas A&M, and we have funds locally to actually respond to disasters. So the examples of East Palestine and Richmond, Indiana, essentially we're using institutional support to provide travel and other, you know, and transportation, cover those costs, you know, that run into, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. But you cannot, you know, wait for NIH to actually provide those funds for you. Also, we're not actually a responders. We're not a contract research organization. There are a lot of contractors that are being deployed, CTH and other companies. And actually, anecdotally, the instrument that our colleagues at Carnegie Mellon had, they leased that instrument. And the company actually called that instrument back because now Norfolk Southern is using that instrument to roam around and actually do the testing. The instrument that we have is Texas A&M instrument, and therefore we have more control of long-term commitments that we're making to the community.
Great, thanks. I think that kind of answers the question, was this NIH funded for all of this research? So it sounds like there's multiple funding sources. Okay.
We appreciate the starter funding from NIH, yes, but that's a separate conversation.
Thank you. This is an interesting question. So for this kind of research, have you ever tried using AI or machine learning, or maybe is that something you think about doing in the future?
Let me start in saying that, again, with institutional support, we have a pilot project program here in our center. And one of the pilot projects that we funded in the last cycle, you know, last 6 months, was to develop an, you know, ChatGPT-enabled, you know, text messaging capability for citizens to report environmental concerns. And I welcome you to our website under resources and click on my Enviro screen. I'm forgetting the term, but there is a bot that's actually operational. We built one for North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality Standards, one for Harris County, one for Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. We're also working very closely with California EPA as well. So these are things we're trying and will determine how best to use them.
I'll say that's another good I'm so sorry. I was just
going
to say community engagement, because we're actually working with a lot of our existing partnerships to, you know, create, you know, tweaks on this, to be able to use it to make sure they can be able to report environmental issues. And I believe it's called the My Eco Reporter.
Great. Thank you all. I think in just in the essence of time, we'll have to move on to our next group of speakers. But thank you again to our Texas A&M colleagues. That was really a wonderful session. So. Okay, so without further ado, next we're going to have Michigan State University, their SRP Center. We're joined by Dr. Norbert Kaminsky. He's a professor of pharmacology and toxicology at Michigan State University and also the director of the Michigan Superfund Research Program Center. We're also joined by Dr. Brian Teppin, a soil chemist at the university, and Dr. Brian Johnson, who studies strategies that lead to the prevention of birth defects and disease in vulnerable populations. So Dr. Kaminsky, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Well, Danielle, thank you very much for that introduction. And I think I'm charged in to give a brief introduction to our Superfund Center, and then I'll turn the presentations over to two of my colleagues. So next, if you go to the next slide. So the central overarching theme for our Superfund Center at Michigan State University is to define environmental, microbial, and mammalian biomolecular responses to environmental contaminants that act as agonists for the AH receptor. So primarily what we're focused on are dioxin and dioxin-like compounds. Next. The reason we've selected this theme is because about 80 miles due north of the Michigan State campus, we have a fairly significant a Superfund site with contamination with dioxin and also dibenzofurans. So these are dioxin-like compounds. And what you're looking at is actually an aerial map of the Tittabawassee River, which snakes from Midland all the way down through, and unfortunately, I don't have a pointer since you're doing my slides, but continues downstream all the way to where it empties in Lake Huron. And so what you're, the various colored bars that you're looking at are core samples where back in 2006, the Environmental Protection Agency, as they were doing some core sampling, discovered that there was contamination of the river sediment as well as the adjacent river floodplain with these dioxin-like compounds. And so these are really a byproduct of legacy manufacturing practices by the Dow Chemical plant, which actually is to the left of your screen, and you can see where it starts and it goes all the way downstream to Lake Huron. And so not only are the communities along the, you know, the river affected, but a lot of this is rural area, so also wildlife. And so it really has an impact on this recreational center, which is this river. Next. And so the Michigan State Superfund Center consists of five projects. Three of these are biomedical, and two of them are environmental science and engineering. Project one, which I direct, is primarily focused on elucidating the molecular mechanisms by which dioxin-like compounds affect humoral immunity, or your body's ability to produce antibodies. Project two, which you'll hear more from in right after I finish by Brian Johnson, his project is focused on the effects of dioxin-like compounds on the thyroid gland and the ability of these compounds to disrupt thyroid hormone homeostasis. Project three is focused on the liver, which is led by Tim Zakharewski. And again, this project primarily is focused on AH receptor-mediated metabolic reprogramming associated with changes in cholesterol biosynthesis in the liver, and its mechanistic link to progression of hepatic steatosis, which is fatty liver. And this fatty liver disease can progress to fibrosis and be quite destructive to the liver. And then in terms of our environmental science engineering projects, Project 4, led by Dr. Syed Hassam, primarily is focused on identifying new microorganisms in the environment that are capable of metabolizing these chlorinated, polychlorinated dibenzodioxins and dibenzofurans, with the goal of ultimately identifying enzymes and that are able to degrade these compounds and be used for remediation. And then Project 5, which you'll hear from, that's led by Brian Teppin, is primarily focused on testing the hypothesis that site-specific bioavailability of these dioxin-like compounds in the environment can be affected by black carbon geosorbents. And so much of Project 5 is focused on developing remediation processes utilizing various carbon materials like activated carbon as well. And then, of course, we have all of the required cores, which I'm not going to go through for the sake of time, but we also have something called a computational modeling core that utilizes the data from all five of these projects to not only computationally model them, but also to allow us to do predictions on some of these both biological processes as well as the remediation work that we're doing. And then at the top of the screen, you see all of our many stakeholders and partners, which include not only community groups, but the various regulatory agencies that are working very closely with Dow Chemical to do the remediation of 22 miles of this river. So with that, I'll stop and I'll turn, next please, I'll turn this over to Dr. Brian Johnson, who leads Project 2 for us.
Thank you very much, Norb. So as you said, I'm Brian Johnson. I'm assistant professor at Michigan State. And the title of Project 2 is Coupled Computational and Bioengineered Models of Thyroid Imbalance to Support Dioxin and Furan Risk Assessment. Next, I do have a conflict of interest. Actually, technology spun out of an EPA-funded project in my postdoc. We created a company and are funding that through SBIR funding. And so, but we still use that device and make them in the lab to sort of avoid conflicts. But just want to make that aware ahead. Next slide. So there's really two simple questions that we started to ask when we got the opportunity to think about having a project in the center. And they are dioxin and furan pollutants really harming human health at environmental levels? And if so, how and at what levels? Next. So here's an overview of that same river section and drainage area. And you can see Midland on the map where it's draining into sort of the area, Saginaw Bay, in between the thumb. And so we really want to know what this pollution is doing at the local level and then throughout the country, because there are also exposures to these through burning garbage and other factors. Next slide. So to understand what's happening here in the U.S., we can look to data on other environmental releases of dioxins. And so the most sensitive known human health endpoint for dioxins is actually thyroid imbalance. And that data comes from a chemical plant explosion in the 1970s in Seveso, Italy. And you can see on the map, sort of in that middle brightly colored area, where you have areas with high, moderate, and low-level dioxin exposures in the soil. And so really interestingly, what they found in 2008 were if they measured mothers that grew up in these areas and then had children 25 years after that chemical plant exposure, what they found is that their children had dose-dependent responses in thyroid-stimulating hormone in their heel prick assays that you get at birth. And so this is really data that we don't usually have, dose response data in humans. Now, there's a couple of things that are really important about that. For one, our science to date has really thought that rodents are much more, even overly sensitive to dioxins and furans, that they are about 40-fold more sensitive because the mechanism that is presumed is much higher in those animal models. However, if you extrapolate that data out from this thyroid assay, these effects happen actually at 34 lower exposures than we see thyroid effects in rats. There's a typo in the bottom of that line. But so a total flip-flop in sensitivity. Recent data suggesting that rodent models suggest that the mechanism that we're currently relying our risk assessments on may not be correct. And so really what we wanted to do was to build a human-derived system so that we could sort of understand the human health risk implications and understand what the sensitivity is to human populations. Next. And so when you start there, unfortunately, it gets really complicated. And I'm not going to go through this whole figure, but this is an adverse outcome pathway network that shows on the left all the different molecular initiating events and ways that chemicals can start to act to disrupt thyroid hormone balance. In the middle areas of that map are key events and sort of physiological changes that we can measure in animal or human systems. And on the right are the adverse outcomes, the diverse adverse outcomes that we can have. And so in adolescence, we can have cognitive and learning defects. In adults, we can have cancer. And so it's really complicated. And so one thing we start to ask is, what can we do to really tease apart, get at the core question we want to? Next slide. And so to do that, we turn and partner with our computational modeling core to really start to put math and numbers to what we really know about this system. And so it's a physiologically based pharmacokinetic model for thyroid hormones. And what that does is it really starts to measure not only where in the body are these thyroid molecules, but what compartments, and it also takes into account the rates they move in and out of those different compartments throughout the body. And so in working with that, what we can do is some sensitivity analysis. We can start to understand, okay, what really are the systems, the organs that we want to look at? So for example, we know from our AOP network before and the computational modeling that we want thyroid compartment, liver compartment, and we need to have those interacting between the two. Next slide, or next image. And so to do that, the technology that we use is really independent of any existing biology. So what we can do is take the best systems here. So we take what we feel are the best hepatocyte spheroid assays developed by Steve Ferguson intramurally, and then this thyrocyte follicle assay that Chad Dysonroth has developed intramurally. And we can put those models together in these high throughput, really technically simple, but enabling technologies that we engineer in the lab and start to build these sorts of models. Next slide. You can advance through these about four clicks, I think. There we go. And so we take standard microplates and we can either machine in the top here as shown, and we build code in our engineering lab to cut out the areas between the wells as shown on the top. Next click. We can also engineer these in the bottom. So we have models of orofacial development, et cetera. Next slide. So this is just how it functions. Next click. You can see here there's integrated microchannels that now join these two different models together. And you can do about nine clicks now. And so as we go through here, we fill one cell volume up with our hepatocytes. We come in again, next click, and fill in our thyrocytes. And we can co-incubate, we can let these mature in their own medias. Next slide. And next slide, we can come back in, and then when we're ready, we can merge them. And so now these are in liquid co-culture. Next slide. And you can have communication, either metabolites diffusing from one well to another, metabolized small molecules diffusing, hormones produced by one compartment acting in another compartment. And so we have a system that's starting to mimic some of the major human biology that we've identified through our computational modeling that we need in the system. Next slide. Next. We can move through. This is just showing how it works. I think the key operation here to understand is that it's very high throughput. So you can see the wells on the left are blue and yellow. Those are two different cell types if we seed at low volume. And then when we raise the volume, we get mixing in green. And so there's no pumps, there's no things to complicate the system. Next slide. So the overarching aims that we've got in our model are shown on the left. So we see that we're combining our bioengineering technologies that we've developed in our own lab. We're partnering with the people that we really need that have the expertise in computational modeling to help fill in the gaps and prioritize what to test. And then in our aims, we're doing a few different things to explore the biology. So in aim one, we're measuring the kinetics and the metabolism of these thyroid hormones in our systems, but we're also starting to measure mechanisms of thyroid hormone action. So what thyroid hormone does is really drive cellular energy metabolism. And so we're building readouts in high content using high throughput image-based systems that we can measure in real time, over time, how these responses are occurring. So for mitochondrial membrane potential, we can treat an antagonist of the thyroid hormone receptor and see that we can knock it down there in panel B on the right in either primary hepatocytes using a chemical antagonist. Interestingly, and I will stay and see, this is very preliminary data, but what we are starting to see is that in a couple different cell models that we can induce our metabolism with thyroid hormone, which is really interesting. We can control that system. But if we co-expose with dioxins, that we can antagonize that response. And we're working through what might occur to happen. So now that we've got that system in place. Next. In AIM2, we're putting our co-culture model together. So that initially we're working in hepatocytes to build our readouts. But here we seed our primary human thyrocytes. On day five, our primary hepatocytes are seeded on day zero. They, again, develop and mature in their own medias. So now here in panel B on the right, you see our primary thyrocyte follicles, and this matches what Chad Eisenroth sees in his system. So we've adopted that. And we've got our spheroid model on the right there. And that's when we actually put them into co-culture. So they're physically next to each other, but not able to communicate. And so then we add our treatments in, and we can show that after we've added our treatments there on day 10 and monitored to day 12, we can measure fluorescent responses and metabolism. We can show here in the panel on the bottom that they're still responsive to thyroid stimulating hormone, suggesting that we've really still kept a lot of that really critical biology that we want to maintain in our system. Next slide. Finally, and I think this is one of the most fun things that has been a struggle for a while, is now we've got this in vitro system, right? How do we really extrapolate it back to humans? And so while we're looking at mixtures that are important in the Tiwassee River Valley for a lot of these dioxin and furoncogeners that we really see, the other thing that we're doing is, again, partnering with our computational biologists. And by understanding the rates that these are changed by the different biology, we can plug those things in back to a computational model. And then if we populate that data with known human levels, physiological levels of here on the graph on the bottom right with three free thyroxine hormone on the x-axis and thyroid stimulating hormone on the y-axis. In blue there is what a human population, about 10,000 people, if you plot out those two levels of hormone in the system, what it looks like. But now we can actually extrapolate and say, okay, if we change some of these rates by a twofold, for example, of clearance of thyroxine, what is that going to do on the human population level? And what's interesting is we see that a lot of the people stay in, those dotted lines really represent the normal, what's considered clinically normal in humans. We see that most people still stay inside that range, but there are sensitive subpopulations that get moved out of the clinical range. And so we can pre-identify who those individuals are and target interventions to help avoid exposures. Next slide. So again, at the end of this, I think some of the really important questions we want to get to is, what are the mechanisms? Do we have it right or do we have it wrong in humans versus animal models? How do these in vitro findings translate to human level effects? And what populations are really most susceptible to these dioxin and furan pollutants? Next slide. So with that, I really want to thank the people that do the work in my lab, especially Carrie Gardner, who's done a lot of the initial metabolism work, as well as Meredith Adams, a really phenomenal third year now medical resident who did a lot of initial work. And then the Ching Zhang lab at Emory through the computational modeling core and Max Baga, who developed and really enlightening us and giving us so much more context to what we can design in our in vitro systems. Chad Dysonroth and Steve Ferguson, who helped adopt the models. Everyone at the P42 Center has been fantastic. And of course, the funding from the research program. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Brian. Project 5 addresses bioavailability as a concept in determining remediation goals and strategies for PCDDF contaminated Superfund sites. I work on that with Hoy Lee and Steve Boyd at Michigan State and Cliff Johnston at Purdue University. Next slide, please. PCDDF stands for a molecule like this. This is dibenzo p-dioxin. The white atoms are all hydrogens on dibenzodioxin, but if you replace any of those with chlorines, next slide, please, then it becomes a polychlorinated dibenzodioxin, okay? And so illustrated here is 2378 tetrachloro, dibenzopubdioxin, TCDD for short. This is the most toxic of these PCDDFs and a standard by which, you know, toxicity is compared. The solubility of this molecule in water is only 19 part per trillion, 19 nanogram per liter. And so essentially all of these molecules, these dioxin-like compounds, are found on particles in soils and sediments, not in water. Next slide, please. So going back to our title, what does bioavailability mean? Basically, the ability of a toxin to cause a biological effect, usually meaning that it can cross some critical biological membrane. And the main route of exposure for people and other animals to PCDDFs is by eating. Foods can be contaminated with these compounds. Children and many other animals eat soil, and that can cause ingestion of these molecules. And so what does bioavailability look like when these materials are in soils? Next slide, please. here's a review of the literature for bioavailability experiments feeding soils to mammals. On the y-axis is the bioavailability relative to PCDDFs that are in corn oil. And on the x-axis is the PCDDF content of various soils that have been fed to swine, to rats, to guinea pigs, and mice. And so 100% would be the availability in corn oil. All of these soils exhibit bioavailabilities that are lower. Some are near zero. Most of them are below 50%. Next slide, please. Unfortunately, the soils that were used, these contaminated soils, were not characterized very well. Maybe some still exist and could be characterized, but they basically don't provide any risk management hypotheses as a result. Next slide, please. And since there's no kind of strong hypothesis for how soil properties affect bioavailability, EPA still must assume that the bioavailability of PCDDFs in soils is 100%. That's inconsistent with the data, but the regulators are charged with maintaining safety. And so this is a major risk assessment knowledge gap, since the observed bioavailabilities are mostly, 50% or less. Next slide, please. So we've tried to address this, and so I need to briefly describe kind of what are the main compartments that we build soils from, that soils kind of the main sorbents for dioxin-like compounds in soils would include the clay minerals, very small layers that can expand relative to each other and could hold toxins between those layers. Many other types, hundreds and thousands of types of other minerals that are non-layered typically, but maybe porous. We can't address all of those. The most common by far is silica, which makes up most sand and silt, kind of the medium to largest particles of soil. Then there's amorphous organic matter, which is residue of plants and animals that is just microbially decomposed without any burning, just oxidation by microbes. I'm going to call that amorphous organic matter, or AOM. And then there is a different type of organic matter that we can call pyrogenic, because it's fire-derived carbonaceous materials. I may call them PCMs. That could result from a forest fire or grass fire. In an extreme form, they can be manufactured as activated carbon. And we will utilize these materials in our studies. Next slide, please. So in order to try to address the bioavailability knowledge gap, what we've done is take TCDD as a representative PCDD and apply it to, let's say, porous silica. Feed that material to mice, and we saw that the biological effects were just the same as if it was administered in corn oil. It was 100% bioavailable. We did the same with various clay minerals. Again, 100% bioavailable, same biological effects as if delivered in corn oil. We did it with amorphous organic matter, and again, same biological effects. Only with activated carbon that we've tried so far have we fed TCDD to mice and seen no biological effects. In this case, the TCDD was loaded onto the activated carbon ahead of time, and the mice after that looked the same as mice that had ingested no TCDD. Next slide, please. So this begins to help us understand the role of these pyrogenic materials. And so our overall goal is to test the efficacy of activated carbon as a remediation remedy, because if it could be used, it'd be much lower cost and lower impact than the traditional method of treating PCDD contaminated soils now is to dig them up and move the entire depth of soil to a hazardous waste landfill, which is extremely expensive and disruptive. So what does it mean to be a good remediation remedy? Next slide, please. The CERCLA regulations on the right show that, number one, protect human health and the environment, and then several other criteria. That is written into law. On the left is how EPA tries to operationalize those regulations. Next slide, please. And what we've done in our project is to try to create specific aims that address those EPA criteria that they use to implement the circular regulations. And so we are working to really, for the first time, show that there's some remediation that can protect human health or at least mammalian health when TCDD is ingested, and to look at that in the long term and the short term. Next slide, please. So we are constructing soils in a way that we control very well the materials that are representative of soils, but in a way that is well tested and usable for reproducible mouse feeding. And so we're adding clay minerals, silica, this amorphous organic matter, and then activated carbon in various ratios, creating microcosms, and then observing those chemically and biologically. Next slide, please. So for example, specific aims 2 and 3A start with the TCDD sorbed to clay minerals, which we know already is 100% bioavailable to mice, then add activated carbon and look through time at how the system changes to try to understand those short-term kinetics associated with a remediation where activated carbon may be added to a soil. So we will frequently extract chemically the TCDD and do a full mass balance. We'll do that very frequently. And then when those results look interesting, we will occasionally do another bioavailability experiment with mice to try to see whether the absorption of TCDD by the activated carbon correlates with the observed bioavailability when that entire soil is fed to mice. Okay, so trying to observe the relationship between absorption and bioavailability through time when activated carbon is used as a remediation technology. Next slide, please. And then another major aim is to see if once TCDD is on activated carbon, so here we're going to begin time zero means all the TCDD is on activated carbon. And then over time, does that remain stable and does bioavailability stay zero as time progresses through, 4 years or 5 years of this grant? And so, again, doing chemical extractions frequently, and then occasionally when those data look interesting, do another bioavailability study to, again, correlate how much is in the activated carbon phase with how bioavailable is the TCDD in those soils. So thanks very much, and we'll be glad to take questions.
Great. Thank you so much, Brian, and Norb. Really appreciate that. And I just want to remind our audience again to please submit your questions using the Q&A box. So I think we'll go ahead and take a look and see what we've got. So the first one that came in, and I think, Brian would like to answer this question. Brian Johnson. So several of those impacts appear to be similar endpoints. So I'm assuming the impacts to the thyroid seem to be very similar to those concerned associated with PFAS. Do you know if anyone is working on teasing out which of those pollutants are primarily causing the health effects?
Yeah, so, you know, in human populations, when you have common exposures to many different chemicals at low levels over time, it's really, really challenging to be able to tease those factors apart, right? What's the most responsible? You know, I think our approach has been incorporate as much of the biology, as many of the molecular initiated events we know that can sort of disrupt this system into an individual system, and then be able to start to test mixtures and ask those questions, and then use the computational modeling to try to extrapolate back out what is the relative contribution to each of the to risk for each of those compounds. So it's a fantastic question. You know, we've engineered our model. I think in AIM-2, we're looking at PXR and CAR agonists, which is thought to be how some of those PFAS are interacting with thyroid. And so we hope to be able to look at some of that, but it's a great question.
Great. I'm just going to move over to Dr. Johnson, then I'll get, to Dr. Teppan, and then I'll get back to Dr. Johnson. So to Dr. Teppan, another question for you is, if you use activated carbon, does that material also need to be removed from the area after remediation?
Thank you for that. Typically not. You know, the concept is typically not. And that's one of the outstanding questions regarding activated carbon as a remediation technology is the pollutant, the TCD in this case, remains in the soil with the activated carbon, right? And so one of the objectives that we're also working on is to partner with our community engagement corps. And they are surveying local populations, the impacted populations in three different parts of Michigan, to find out whether that would be an acceptable remediation technology to the people in those communities. Because that's one of the EPA criteria for implementing the circular regulations, is it needs to be acceptable solution to the everyday people. And so you know, if one can show that over extended periods, the bioavailability remains zero, and also argue for the practicality that it would enable hundreds of times more sites to be remediated in some fashion because it's much, much cheaper to do, you know, then through interacting with the public around those questions, we can maybe address whether it's acceptable to leave it in the soil or not. If not, there are potential ways to remove it as well, but that'd be, you know, quite a bit more costly too.
Yeah, thanks. Just to follow up on Brian, I mean, we've worked with activated carbon in collaboration with Brian for quite some time now, and it binds so strongly to the activated carbon that we have actually not found good ways to extract it. And the binding is so strong. And so technically it would not be bioavailable, as we think not, if remediated in this manner.
Very interesting. Looks like you have lots of work to do. So that's good. Just one last question. This is to Dr. Johnson. What type of exposure to dioxin furans does this method translate to? Is it ingestion, inhalation, or dermal?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, dioxin, I think exposure is always so important. However, it is much more important for shorter lived compounds. Unfortunately, I think 90% of dioxin exposure is thought to come through food, through ingestion right now. But a 7-year half-life means that even if it's, no matter how it's absorbed, it's around in the system and mixing in the general system quite a bit. And so I think those two things play into factor, but exposures, routes of exposure are certainly important. Perhaps less so with dioxin, but I don't know if it's fully known.
Great, thank you. So thank you to our Michigan State University group. That was a really great set of presentations. So we will have to move on to our next group.
So next
we're going to hear from one of our newer centers, and that's from the Yale University Superfund Center. So we're joined by Dr. Vasilis Vasilou. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Environmental Health Sciences and the director of the Yale University SRP Center. Then we're going to be joined by Dr. Ying Cheng, a research scientist in epidemiology. And then we're going to hear from Dr. Jae-Hong Kim, who is the Henry P. Becton Senior Professor of Engineering at Chemical and Environmental Engineering at Yale. He will not be joining us live, but he does have a pre-recorded presentation. So Dr. Vasilis, our the center director, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having us. Thank you for attending our presentation. As Danielle said, we're a new center. And
Vasilis, you're muted.
Oh, I'm apologies. I thought it was okay. Thank you very much, Danielle, for the introduction. Thank you very much. I'm a professor and chair of the Department of Environmental Health Sciences here at the Yale School of Public Health. And as Danielle said, I'm directing the Yale Superfund Research Center, which is on emerging water contaminants. May I have the next slide, please? So what is water contaminants of emerging concern? These are chemicals that they have been detected in global drinking water supplies at trace levels for which the risk of humans is not very well known or completely evaluated. And of course, this can go from industrial chemicals to endocrine disrupting compounds to pharmaceutical, as you know, personal care products, actually, which we'll discuss later, contained quite a bit of 1,4-dioxane, which is the centers, and also pesticides. May I have the next slide, please? So what is the overall objective of our center? We plan to improve public health protection from these emerging contaminants in the drinking water and apply advanced research technique and communication strategies to detect, to evaluate toxicologically, ensure assessment, mitigation, and also be sure that we have a community outreach involving these contaminants. And the center theme of our center is 1,4-dioxane, and as we'll discuss a little bit later, it's also some co-contaminants that they go along with it. So 1,4-dioxane is a carcinogen, a possible carcinogen established by IARC and EPA. It is in water. It's unregulated in most of USA and Europe. The idea here is when we say it's a probable carcinogen, studies in mice have shown that it can cause liver cancer, but there is no epidemiological evidence supporting that because simply there are no epidemiological studies performed yet. And we're not going to do epidemiological studies, but we're attempting to do an exposure assessment. May I have the next slide, please? So we focus that because it appears in water superfund sites. It is listed on ATSDR. It has been prioritized by EPA for the third unregulated monitor rule, UCMR3, testing that occurred in 2013 and 2015, and you will see why is that. And also, as I told you, it coexists at Superfund sites with with trichloroethane, dichloroethane, and trichloroethylene. So the other thing is that of 28 chemicals tested by UCMR3, 1,4-dioxane was the second and most frequently detected above the risk-based reference concentration. That was accounting for 6.9 on tested public supplies. Now that, you know, this UCMR3, it does not really go into the public wells that you can have some more increased levels, and we have some cases that we will discuss. Another reason that we focused on 1,4-dioxane, when I came to Yale, I went directly to the Department of Public Health and Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, And I asked what was the major threat to the state in terms of chemical pollution. And at that time, they told me it was 1.4 dioxane. The PFAS were not up to the point yet. But 1.4 dioxane was representing a major issue because they could not filter it, and they could find it in several either public supplies or wells. May I have the next slide, please? So here is from the UCRM3, and this is what you can see, that essentially northeast is quite a bit contaminated with 1.4 dioxins, and there is a little bit also in California. I mean, you can find it everywhere, but the doses above the reference concentration is mostly here in the northeast area and the other cases. May I have the next slide, please? So as I told you before, one of the things that really struck me was that 1.4 dioxane was found along with those co-contaminants in multiple sites. And on the left, you can see this was in United States that has been identified in several sites. And on the right-hand side, you can see that the same thing happens in Europe. This is the study from Germany. There are a number of studies. So this is because 1.4 dioxane was used to be as a stabilizer of these organic solvents. And so wherever there was a spill of all this, there was 1.4 dioxane. So it's been found in most of the cases. Now, somebody might say, well, it is a very little, it's kind of low in the ATSDR list. But one of the reasons for that is in prior years, people were not really looking for 1.4 dioxane because it was not known that it was present in all these Superfund sites. So now it started becoming more and more evident that 1.4 dioxane, it really may pose a threat to public health. May I have the next slide, please? So in this area now, it starts getting a lot of attraction. And I'll tell you why. This was from the Engineering News, which they characterized the 1.4 dioxane as another forever chemical. And one reason that this has been characterized by as one forever chemical is, as I told you, it's very difficult to filter it, so it really penetrates everywhere. And in order to get rid of 1.4 dioxane, you need to have a reverse osmosis, which is a very expensive method to have it in individual houses and so on. So in addition to the industry using it as a stabilizer, it has been used also or been created as a byproduct in the plastic industry, and it's still continuing to be contaminating public waters. May I have the next slide, please? So as you will see later, one of the areas that they have the higher levels of 1.4 dioxane in public waters was the Long Island in New York. And this was really high levels. And one of the reasons for that is public water from that comes from big wells. And they have really elevated levels, as you can see, of 1.4 dioxane. Another state which is very important is North Carolina, and that 1.4 dioxane has been identified into the river, the Cape Fear River Basin, and there is a lot of fears about having this into the drinking water. May I have the next slide, please? So in addition to that, now we have also the colleagues from Michigan. Ann Arbor, Michigan has groundwater pollution, which essentially a new study shows that it can be evaporized through the basement. So there was there was a company there that has make a big contamination in the area and has the dioxin plumes. And essentially, right now, there is a major concern from the citizens, and I'm working with University of Michigan and also with the citizens of there trying to see what is going on and how we can help them in terms of the 1.4 dioxane. May I have the next slide, please? So It's not only our harbor, and we have New Jersey. So what happened last year is the public water company in New Jersey identified that there were there was high levels of 1.4 dioxane in their drinking water. So essentially what they did is they traced it down and they found that Dow Chemicals had made a major chemical spill that has generated this plant. And there is dioxane now goes to the rivers and then goes to the drinking water. As a matter of fact, as you can see, March 23, there was a lawsuit against the Dow Chemicals and the Dow Chemical Company for that reason. So now you can start seeing that this dioxane case starts getting a lot of attraction from many states. As a matter of fact, I was just interviewed by Florida a couple of weeks ago, and they're going to be having a report in there because they have now identified dioxane in this case. So the more we measure, the more we find it, and as you will see later, we'll talk to you about why we have concerns. May I have the next slide, please? So we have summarized the effects and all of what was public information, public knowledge about 1.4 dioxane going from sources, fate and transport, remediation, exposure assessment, adverse health outcome in a very nice overview that you can find out that was published in the Science of Total Environment. May I have the next slide, please? So we have synthesized our center, and our center has become the focus of our center, as I said, is 1.4 dioxane and the mixtures that coexist. So in addition to the course that I'm not going into it, we have two biomedical projects, and we also have two environmental science and engineering research projects. And may I have the next slide? Oh, before I go to that, I want to tell you that this is a collaboration between Yale School of Public Health and Engineering mostly, but we also have the School of the Environment and also the School of Medicine. So this is an effort based on four different schools at Yale that we're focusing on studying this compound and the mixtures. May I have the next slide, please? So as you will hear later from Dr. Chen, the project one is looking for mechanisms by which 1.4 dioxane is expressing its carcinogenic properties. And as I said, these are studies in mice and rats, actually, and they're confirming that 1.4 dioxane can cause cancer. The project two that we're not going to cover today, it's led by Nicole Deiser and Brian Lederer, and we're doing exposure assessment. We don't have enough budget to do big epidemiological study, but this is going to be the first assessment of exposure assessment of 1.4 dioxane. Project three is to develop sensors in order to detect the contaminants, not only 1.4 dioxane and also the other contaminants. And the big goal of this project is to see if we can have detectors that are going to be online, in other words, real-time sensors that we can monitor the contaminations by the waters. And the fourth project is led by Jae-Hong Kim, and you're going to hear about it, is how we can develop devices which are cheap and can decompose 1.4 dioxane. And he is proposing to use the advanced oxidation treatment that you will hear more information about it. May I have the next slide, please? So this is just a little bit of a taste of what you're going to hear. So Dr. Chen is going to talk to us about liver cancer and what we have found, what the animal models we're using. And this is from our exposure assessment sites that we're essentially going to start with New York, and later we're going to go to North Carolina. And the project four, which is the advanced oxidation. So this just to give you a taste, and we're going to follow that. Next. As we said, we're a new center, but we try our best. And I have to tell you, in addition to all attractions that we have got based on publishing our webpage and everything, I've been getting even phone calls in my office almost every other day from citizens now that they're worried about the 1.4 dioxane and they want to find more information. So for our community engagement, we don't have time to describe you today. We have partnered with Citizens Campaign for the Environment, which is located in the Long Island. And I have met with them from 2016-17. And we start talking with the community. And we held a major event a couple of days ago. And already we have 500 people already registered that they want to come to participate in, in further studies in terms of exposure assessment or measuring their houses for well water and everything. This is, as you can see, it made the news immediately, and we're getting more and more. And this is what we would like to use. We try to use innovative ways. But first of all, we need to have some face-to-face meetings with the citizens that they have been affected. They know that they have that, and we have to go for it. One thing before we go to Dr. Chen's is I would really like, and I wish I had the time to go over with you. This is the personal care products and the household items. They contain quite a bit high levels of 1.4 dioxane. So given that the state of New York, and because they had the problems with the Long Island, they introduce a legislation by which they prohibit, they phasing out all these companies utilizing 1.4 dioxane in their household items. And I wish in one of the seminars, which will be going through the SRP program again, we will show you how these household items could also result in higher exposures to 1.4 dioxane and higher not only exposures but also accumulations into the waters of our houses and the waters that they go down for purification. With that, I'm gonna stop here, and I'm gonna let Dr. Chen talking to you about our project one, which essentially sees the major drive on this project.
Hi, you all hear me well? Okay, good afternoon. My name is Yin Chen. I'm a research scientist in the Department of Environmental Health at the Yale School of Public Health. And I would be in the next 5 minutes briefly introducing and sharing some of the exciting findings with the project one, which we target at the mechanistic aspects of the toxicity and liver carcinogenicity of 1,4 dioxin, looking at both as a single chemical component and also as part of the mixture of water contaminants. So this project one is co-led by myself and Dr. Vasilio, and we also have three young scientists who have been working on this part in the past like eight to 9 months. And we have two collaborators, Dr. Ferguson from NIEHS and Dr. Tangui from the Oregon State University. The goal of the project one is really, we're trying to bridge some knowledge gap that which is the major obstacle for us to establish standardized water guideline for dioxin in the water. So as Dr. Vasilio has already introduced, we are aware there's a widespread water contamination of 1,4 dioxin in the United States as well as worldwide. And 1,4 dioxin is proven liver carcinogen mostly in laboratory animals. However, we don't know what we don't know is what is the mechanism, cancer mechanism of action. And in this big puzzle, there are many pieces that remain to be uncovered, including metabolism, including cellular metabolics, responses, and what type of adverse pathways, all of this, how they are linked or mechanistically linked to the tumorigenesis related with dioxin exposure. So the research goals of Project One is to identify molecular mechanism involved in 1,4-dioxin liver carcinogenicity, and importantly also to assess the capacity of co-occurring contaminants in modifying such effects. So we have proposed three aims. The aim one, we are using unique redox mouse models, which we target CYP2E1, which is believed a very important enzyme in 1,4-dioxin metabolism. And then glutathione, which is the most abundant antioxidant in the liver. And then last is NRF2, which is the master regulator of antioxidant response to xenobiotic exposures. And then in the aim one, we have two phases of exposure studies. The phase one is a high dose screening phase. Phase two is a low dose carcinogenic study. And then the aim two will utilize the samples derived from the aim one for multi-omics systemic analysis, and then data coming from the transcriptomic metabolomics will be linked to our phenotyping data, particularly the liver phenotypes. And this data will be integrated to get information that hopefully will lead us to some novel knowledge in terms of the mechanism of 1,4-dioxin carcinogenicity, and as well as some exposure or toxicity biomarkers. And the third aim is the co-exposure studies, that this study will be performed by our collaborators, by Dr. Ferguson's group, using the HEPA, human HEPA-RG at the in vitro model system, and then by Dr. Tanguy's group using the zebrafish as an in vivo model. Both of these are high throughput screening platform that we can look at the co-exposure effects. So I would just quickly share some findings, highlights of our findings from the mouse study in the aim one. So in the phase one, we exposed three transgenic strains, two transgenic strains plus the wild type mice. And then look at the redox-associated changes. And these mice are exposed to 5,000 ppm in the drinking water of dioxin for 3 months. And what we found are that the dioxin does have the direct genotoxic effects. And this process involves oxidative stress. And then the CYP2E1 appeared to play a dominant role in the 1,4-dioxin metabolism and also 1,4-dioxin-induced liver cytotoxicity. However, we did find there are genotoxic effects seemingly independent of CYP2E1 function. And what we found out in the low exposure cohorts, where mice were exposed to 5,500 ppm of dioxin for 6 months. We just completed the initial phenotypic characterization of this cohort. And what we found that's this at this lower doses in any of those genetic strains, we did not find significant systemic or hepatic toxicity. However, very excitingly, and we did find a higher incidence of developing hepatocellular hypoplasia lesions, specifically in the low GSH model and particularly in the male mice. So with the samples for the AIM-2, we have already finished the sample processing, and we are collecting data and doing the data analysis, look at the plasma metabolomics, liver metabolomics, transcriptomics, and for this part, we only just completed the high dose cohorts, and we wish to continue for the lower low dose cohorts in the next funding cycle. So this will end my talk. And I will start Dr. King's.
Hello, my name is Jaehong Kim, and I'm very pleased to present Yale Superfund Research Center project number 4, modular chemical-free advanced oxidation of 1,4-dioxane and its co-contaminants in groundwater. On behalf of project co-PI, Professor John Fortner, and also our wonderful center trainees, Dr. Wenxi Chen, David Kim, Seung-hee Che, and Leslie Arazolo.
We're not able to hear the recording. You might have to press play.
Techniques such as carbon adsorption and membrane filtration that are often used in household. Therefore, the objectives of project
should I replay it?
Is a
very yes.
Is highly soluble. Does not adsorb onto surfaces. Hello, my name is Jaehong Kim.
Can you hear now?
I'm very pleased to present Yale Superfund Research Center project number 4, modular chemical-free advanced oxidation of 1,4-dioxane and its co-contaminants in groundwater. On behalf of project co-PI, Professor John Fortner, and also our wonderful center trainees, Dr. Wenxi Chen, David Kim, Seung-hee Che, and Leslie Arazolo. One for dioxane is a very small organic compound, is highly soluble, does not adsorb onto surfaces, has no charge, and doesn't even easily evaporate. All these unique properties make one for dioxane as one of the most difficult compounds to remove using conventional treatment techniques such as carbon adsorption and membrane filtration that are often used in household. Therefore, the objectives of Project 4 is to develop point of use, small scale and chemical supply free water treatment units that can destroy 1,4-dioxane and its frequently co-occurring pollutants such as trichloroethylene, 1,1-dichloroethane and 1,1-1-trichloroethane from contaminated groundwater through advanced oxidation. We employ advanced oxidation, which employs strong oxidation power of hydroxyl radical, which is produced from on-site from oxygen and water using electricity as a sole energy source, but without using any additional chemical. We will test the prototype reactors both in the lab and in region 1 field sites to verify the feasibility of real-world use, to confirm elimination of human toxicity, and to establish faster technology transfer in collaboration with other project teams. This diagram shows how our research hypothesis and specific aims constitute Project 4. In specific aim 1, we study a modular electrochemical cell that produces hydrogen peroxide from oxygen in water and a subsequent catalytic scheme that produces hydroxyl radical on site to destroy 1,4-dioxane. In specific aim 2, we investigate the feasibility of using nanobubble-enabled advanced oxidation. And in specific aim 3, we evaluate efficiency and perform field tests with prototype reactors. We collaborate with Project 1 for biological effect of treatment. And with Project 2 and community engagement core for selection and field testing. And we collaborate with Project 3 and DMAC Core for sensors and data management. Let me share some recent progress that we have made. We successfully synthesized the catalyst, boron-doped carbon catalyst shown here, and fabricated a hydrogen peroxide synthesis cell. We quickly discovered that maintaining the performance in real water metrics would be the key for success of this research to provide a system that can perform for a long period for household application. We therefore developed a framework on how to optimize post-electrolysis to enhance catalytic tolerance against impurities present in water and to improve overall lifetime of the cell. We discovered that optimized pulsing sequence enabled improved long-term hydrogen peroxide performance to nearly 300 hours and 35 times better than conventional electrolysis, even in the presence of most detrimental impurities such as nickel and zinc. These findings make this cell closer to real-world implementation for prolonged hydrogen peroxide synthesis and subsequent one for dioxane destruction. As an alternative technology to destroy one for dioxane, in specific aim 2, we explore the use of engineered gas phase nanobubbles. We perform extensive characterization of nanobubbles in solution with a focus on hydroxyl radical generation and by performing a number of different characterization using degradation of hydroxyl radical specific target compounds, electron paramagnetic resonance spectroscopy, and a fluorescence-based indicator. Through this phase of research, we concluded that nanobubble-induced hydroxyl radical generation is minimal, if not all, but we will continue to study if there is an alternative way to enhance the nanobubble-enabled advanced oxidation.
So this is Dr. King's last slide.
As an alternative technology to destroy,
So we are at the end of our.
Great. Thank you all so much. That was really great. I'm glad that we were able to work out the sound issues. So we have a couple minutes for some questions. Let's just take a look. I think that one was for a previous one. So let's go to some of the questions that were submitted prior to the webinar. So I think Dr. Vassilou, one of the questions that came in was, how is community engagement progressing during the first year of your new center?
Well, it is progressing well. It started a little bit slow because, you know, we got the budgets and especially we had to go with the community engagement, with the partnering outside. But now we're full speed and we're working. And actually, it is very important because people now start realizing with all this news that's coming every day in the newspapers and especially in the area household items in the area of New York that they have been going this back and forth. As a matter of fact, there is some rumors now that the industry would like to sue the state because of this legislations that they have put in there. So this is interesting times and community engagement is really advancing towards that and we have really good support.
Yes, it seems like most of your community now is the United States.
Not yes, just limited. Indeed.
So
yes,
one, indeed. One localized population. So, okay, a question for Dr. Chen then. How do you compare the 1,4-dioxane doses used in your study to human exposure levels?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yes, the dose exposure study we designed in AIM-1 included two phases. The phase one are really high dose. If looking at the level in human population, they're about like 10,000 fold higher. And then the lower one, the lower group 5,500, we considered as environmentally relevant, given the high robust capacity of mouse rodents in the CYP2E1 system, and given the limited time exposure. So, but we hope that the high dose study, even there are high, but they can provide some particularly when we use the mechanistic MOS model, then can give us some information that we can refine the assessments in terms of mechanistic events that will be evoked at the lower dose relevant to environmental exposure.
Great, thank you so much. We've got one more question.
Can I add something else also? Very important thing. What we have been finding is that 1.4-dioxane induces the cytochrome P450-2E1. As you all know, 2E1 is the activator of involved in the TCE metabolism, which makes the metabolites more carcinogenic. So a combination of these two, it could be deadly, and this is what we're also looking. That's why we're doing the cell cultures and eventually trying to go to 3D structures of the liver, but also with the zebrafish, with a facility from the Oregon State University, we trying to expedite the mixtures of 1.4-dioxane plus on the other carcinogens, and some very novel models of addressing liver carcinogenicity. So it's not just the dioxane that may cause the cancer, but it's also the mixtures that can be advancing the cancer as well.
Yes, very, very exciting work. And I wish we did have more time to have some more discussion. There is another question that came in, but we do not have time because I need to start to close up. But again, thank you all so much for really some great presentations. So before we conclude, let's take a look back at the seminar homepage. So this website will be active from today on and contains important resources such as links to download our presentation materials, contact information for our speakers. And so if you do have additional questions for our speakers, please reach out to them directly. That would be really great. There's also more information about our Superfund research program and a link to our feedback form. So we ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. So I'd like to just remind participants of the various ways you can stay connected to ensure you don't miss any of these great webinars. So for more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the CLUIN.org website. You can also subscribe to their monthly newsletter, which is called Tech Direct. And we encourage you to visit the SRP Progress and Research webpage. So check out our monthly research brief and subscribe to our Risky Learning listserv for information about upcoming sessions. And you can also follow us on Twitter. So I'd like to encourage everyone to join us on May 5th, May 12th, and May 19th for the remaining three sessions in this series. In the next session, we're going to hear from two centers working to reduce health risks associated with heavy metal exposures in Native American communities. And if you'd like to join the webinars, the registration is filling up fast, so we encourage you to register now. If you cannot attend, the recordings will be made available after the event. And with that, it's time to conclude today's session. Thank you all for our audience for their participation, and also thank you to our presenters for their time spent preparing and sharing their presentations with us today. Have a good rest of your day. Thank you.